It's interesting, by the way, the Gemara uses that as an example that a teacher, a Rebbe, should never push away a student with both hands. Many times in education, the teacher wants to throttle the student with both hands. But the Gemara talks about gentler things, not to push with both hands. Lolom yehi smol doche v'yamin makarev. You should push with the left hand and hold on to the student with the right hand. Never let go. The Gemara brings instances of great men who pushed their students away, and because of that, tragedies occurred. There's the story of Elisha and Gehazi. So Elisha threw him out and cursed him that he should become a leper, that the tzaraas should come to him. And from that tragedy came forth. And the other, another example that's used there is Yabshua ben Prachya and Yeshu. That the Gemara tells us that they were eating at an inn together, and that the student made an improper reference regarding the waitress to the Rebbe. And Rabbi Shimon ben Prachya was angered angered by what he said, and angered by the fact that he would say it to him. And so he threw him out. And out of that came tragedy. So if we're talking about Rabbi Shimon ben Prachya, we're talking 2 centuries before the rise of Christianity. And really, it has nothing to do with us at all. But even if we don't agree and say that there is the Yeshu, the Jesus that's spoken about in the New Testament, etc., lived at the time of Herod, Agrippus, and I don't know how they knew it was the year 1, but you know, he lives at that time, so. There are other things. First of all, there was no Sanhedrin that was present then anymore, as far as criminal law was concerned. The rabbis teach us that 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the Sanhedrin disbanded as far as criminal law was concerned. So there was no Sanhedrin there to try him even. So the whole story of the head of the Sanhedrin, etc., really is also not based in fact. Secondly, anyone who studies the Mishnah, the Talmud, is well aware that Judaism basically in practice is against the death penalty. In practice. The Mishnah, Rabbi Tarfon, and Rabbi Akiva say that if they were on the Sanhedrin, no one would ever get executed. And the Mishnah says that once once in 70 years, executed somebody, it was called a bloody century, a bloody Sanhedrin. The requirements for executing a person are of such a nature that it's almost impossible to fulfill it as a practical step. And we see, therefore, that today in the state of Israel, for instance, there is no death penalty except for Nazi war criminals. The only person that's ever been executed is Adolf Eichmann. So that even people who are traitors, even treason, and there are people here who, unfortunately, were convicted of treason. There were people who spied for Russia, for the communists, because they felt that that was, the world to come. And there have been other instances. Even those people have never been up for execution, never been up for being tried for their lives. The question of the length of the prison sentence. But it's not a question of life or death, because if the thrust has always been that we don't execute people. And that executing people, that's not to say that people were not executed, but they were executed by the government, not by the Sanhedrin. There's a great difference. And so because of that, this whole, it couldn't happen. Jews were not involved. Could not have been involved. Now, the crucifixion was the method of execution at the time of the Greeks, and the Romans took it over. It was a slow and agonizing death, and many times it took the victim 2-3 days to die. We see in all the representations of Jesus in paintings and in statues, you always see a great gash in his side, because according to one version of the crucifixion, as it appears in the New Testament, he asked a Roman soldier to stab him so that he would die quicker, which the Roman soldier did, and he promised him the world to come. Now, it's interesting. I've always found it really fascinating that almost all the stories in the New Testament are identical stories in the Old Testament or in the Talmud. For instance, all the miracles that were alleged to have been performed are all miracles that we see by Eliyahu, by Elisha. They're all miracles which appear previously in, Sefer Melachim and Sefer Shmuel. There's no, like, original miracle to feed a lot of people with a little bread or fish. You know, so Elisha did that, you know, to turn the water sweet, to raise someone from the dead. These are all, pre-owned miracles. And the same thing is true. This story about the being promised the world to come for stabbing, for hastening the death. So aside from the fact, how do we deal with a God, you know, with a Son of God, with death, with the, I mean, the whole thing is just defies our sense of logic or understanding. But this is the Gemara about Reb Chanina ben Tradyon, that he was being burned to death, and the Romans had placed wool soaked in water over his chest and over his heart and over his vital organs so that he would burn longer. He wouldn't expire quickly. And that he asked the Roman executioner to remove those sponges. And he said, and the Roman said, if I do so, will I be rewarded? And he said, yes. And the Roman did so. And the Gemara says that the Roman Baskel came out from heaven, the voice came out from heaven and said the executioner also is in heaven. So again, you have here parallel stories. And because early Christianity was imbued with all of the ideas and traditions of Judaism, so all of that is reflected in the New Testament. But the New Testament really is the Old Testament warmed over in a different fashion. Even the stories, even the legends. Crucifixion was a terrible form of execution. Terrible form of execution. Agonizing beyond belief. And the Romans were not kind people. And neither were the Greeks. But we find, for instance, Josephus, in his description of the civil war that existed in the Jewish world at the time of Alexander Yanai. So Alexander Yanai was the most powerful of the Hashmonaim kings. We have the Gemara in Kedushin, which tells us that the Prushim, the Pharisees, the Talmidei Chachamim, mounted a rebellion against him, a section of the Talmidei Chachamim, a section of the Pharisees, the diehards. And they said to him, listen, you've got too much power. You can't be the king and the high priest at the same time. Give up one of the jobs. And he had bad advisors, which are not hard to find. And the advisor said, oh, the Prushim are going to make a rebellion against you. You know, they're out to get you. And he was a vicious warrior. So according to Josephus, he crucified 3,000 Talmidei Chachamim at the end of the civil war after he crushed them. So, but Josephus describes that crucifixion was the manner of execution. So as today it's lethal injection. It used to be the electric chair. It used to be hanging. In the Middle Ages, they would stretch the person, break him on the wheel. All sorts of fiendish ways to get rid of people. And so the fiendish way in that time was this terrible form of execution called crucifixion. But it wasn't the Jewish form at all, even though we see that Alexander Yanai used it. But that's because he was influenced by the Hellenists. It was the Greek, complete Greek influence that dominated at least the upper group of Jewish life at the time. The fact that the Romans had him beaten before he was crucified is also, that was the Roman way. I mean, you didn't go quickly or easily by the Romans. There was no mercy bullet. Didn't exist there. This movie, which is I have not seen it, all reports that have appeared in the newspapers, is supposed to be the goriest, most violent, brutal movie ever made. Such, I went through a few newspapers today on the internet to read the reviews, that the reviewers said that they covered their eyes with their hands, you know, like little kids to peek through the fingers, because it was so gory, it's so violent, it's so vulgar that they can't watch it straight. But again, that should have nothing to do with us. However, it does have to do with us because of the statement that I made before, that I explained to you before, that in the New Testament it says that the Jews accepted upon themselves the responsibility for it. In the movie, by the way, the critics also pointed out that even though he took out that sentence, originally that sentence was in the movie as well, that even though he edited it out, nevertheless, all of the Jews are portrayed almost caricature-like. They got big noses, you know, they're short, they got bad teeth. The caricature of a Jew, they got big lips. And so the movie becomes a litmus test of the people who watch it. It's a Rorschach test. The anti-Semites, those that are given to anti-Semitism will see anti-Semitism. Those that really are true believing Christians and subscribe to the ideals of Christianity, which should not destroy Jews, will probably see other things in it. And they won't be as susceptible to that. And then Ramban says that refers to the one that lived 200 years earlier. At that time, the government killed, you know, and it's easily understood that at that time of furor and rebellion, etc., in the early Hashemnoim era, there probably were many people that were killed by the government in order to try and achieve some stability. And if somebody comes and says he's the Messiah, etc., that destabilizes the government. But no one, there's no Jewish source per se. Now, there are many books, legends about Jesus that circulated in the Jewish world. Those are all Bobamises. But they're popular because Jewish people love stories, right? And the less true the story is, the more beloved it is. The greater the fantasy, then that's it, right? So there are all sorts of books in Hebrew and in Yiddish, you know, that exist. Many of them were written in the Middle Ages. And there's a lot of flack floating around. But that doesn't change the basic idea and history of the matter. The church, when they dealt with this problem, so the church had a problem dealing with the Jews generally, because the fact that the Jews rejected Christianity, so the church said that as punishment for rejecting Christianity, that's why the temple was destroyed 35 years later, and that's why the Jews were driven into exile. And that's why the Jews have no hope of ever returning to the land of Israel. They're doomed to be the wandering Jew. We have to acknowledge that, for instance, this pope, who's been a pope a long time, is the longest reigning pope for many, 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 many centuries. He's over a quarter of a century. Because most of the popes, when they come to office, come when they're quite old. And therefore, don't rule that long. But this Pope has recognized the state of Israel and has established diplomatic relations with it. Now, that's not just a political move or a diplomatic move. That's a theological move as well. Because according to certain schools of thought within the church, that's an impossibility for the Jews to be here. And it's an impossibility for them to have their own state and to have sovereignty here. And that was the position of the church for a long period of time. Pope Leo X told Theodore Herzl. Herzl naively went to the Pope to expect him to become a Zionist. And the Pope told him that the only solution to the Jewish problem was that all the Jews should convert to Christianity, which was the position of the church for a long period of time. This Pope has certainly modified it. He's called Judaism Christianity's elder brother. He visited here. He went to the Kotel Maravilla. So to Jews, we don't understand, or perhaps we don't even appreciate the implications of such things. But in the long run of the Catholic Church, these things have never happened before. And therefore, we are witness to a change. It could be that, not could be, it certainly is a reaction to the Holocaust, a reaction to the behavior of Pope Pius XII. But whatever it is, it's a great change. Now, in the Catholic liturgy, there was a line that identified Jews as being perfidious. Perfidious, a good Latin word. Meaning false, hypocritical, not to be trusted. It's not a compliment. I mean, don't tell your father-in-law that he's perfidious, even if he is. And so that line regarding the perfidious Jews, so after the death of Pope Pius XII, after the death of the Pope who was during the Holocaust, the church elected a person whom they thought would be a caretaker until the church sorted itself out. So they took an old archbishop from Milan by the name of Roncalli. Roncalli was a man that saved thousands of Jews during the Holocaust in Italy. And he became Pope John the 23rd. And he took the job seriously. And he came to reform the Catholic Church. And he called councils, Vatican I and Vatican II. And at those councils, great changes were made in the church, changes which have changed the church. Abolished the Latin Mass, for instance. Many other changes in ritual. And one of the things that he did was that he took out this thing about the perfidious Jews. And the second thing that he did is he said that the Jews are not guilty of deicide. The Jews are not guilty of killing God or the Son of God or anything like that. That is against Catholic teaching. What was Catholic teaching now became against Catholic teaching. And he was able to have that passed. Now, when that happened, there was a reaction naturally. Anytime you have changes, so there's always a reaction, and you'll understand what I'm saying because you're all sophisticated. Every religion has a natura carta. See, our natura carta, we're in The Hague, arguing against the fence, like the fence bothers them, right? But they know God's mind, you see. I don't, but they know God. They have no doubts. They're the true believer. And therefore, everything is permissible because you're doing God's work. They didn't figure out yet that Yasser means them too. When the bus can blow up, God forbid, and may assure him also. They didn't figure that out. That part doesn't, you know, they're not working on that length. But, so in yesterday's Jerusalem Post, it was published a whole manifesto of what they say. So, the church also has a whole a section of Christianity that says that the Pope is an apocaris. That all the cardinals that voted for Vatican I and Vatican II and all the changes, they're all, you know, they're reform. And that, what do you mean you did away with Latin? What do you mean that you're allowed to eat meat on Fridays now? And what do you mean you don't have to fast on Good Friday? And all the other things, you know, how did that... And Gibson, for the first part of his career, lived the Hollywood life with all that entails. Lived it to the hilt. And then 15 years ago, he became a Baal Tshuva. He had an epiphany. You know, he met God. And he belongs to this radical Catholic sect. And in fact, he finances, they have a church in Malibu, and he's the one who financed it. And this is part of his expression. You have to be very careful. I always say that people that suddenly gain faith, suddenly gain religion, you have to, you know, it's in the Gemara we see that people who do so die immediately, right? Yesh kone olama b'shoa achas, person can gain the world in one instant, but every case that the Talmud brings, the guy drops dead from it. Because the shock kills him. Because you can't just do that. It has to be, you have to work on yourself from the inside. It's not a blinding flash, you know. It's not the, I believe, right? And like that does it. Billy Graham had 10 million people that said, I believe. Is the world any better than it was before him? Because I believe is an emotional thing at 1 second, right? And then it disappears. And faith is a much more difficult thing to acquire and to inculcate within oneself. Because of that, you have Gibson's father, for instance, who appears to be an out-and-out anti-Semite. Without any, so he says that 6 million Jews didn't die in the Holocaust because he said they're all living in Brooklyn. He says it seriously. So, you know, you have to know where this is coming from. And the more violence and brutality that's shown in the movie, so the movie is not only anti-Jewish in the sense that it can raise anti-Semitism, but if you think about it, it's very anti-Christian. He's getting even with the church, who he feels has lost its way. It's been influenced by modern society and therefore doesn't want to portray what really happened. He's going to show you what really happened, even though there's no one alive that can have any idea as to what really happened. Yeah, as the church said, the movie was accurate and correct as far as the term, as far as what, it's an accurate portrayal of one of the Gospels of the New Testament. But it's accurate and correct. Can't be accurate. How many times did they beat him? It doesn't say, you know, it doesn't say that they turned them over and beat him again in front and not just in the back. It's all of this is, you know, it's Hollywood. Hollywood is also involved here. And his genius was that in the movie, the dialogue is in Aramaic and in Latin. It's only English subtitles. All the Jews speak Aramaic. I don't know where they got that from, right? But the Jews all speak Aramaic, and the Romans all speak Latin. So it's accurate and correct. But the church has been very circumspect regarding the movie. That's all it said. The church didn't condemn the movie, and the church didn't praise the movie. It's interesting that the many church groups in the United States are using the movie or intend to use the movie to raise Christian awareness amongst their parishioners. So even The fundamentalist Christians in the Southern Bible Belt, etc., are buying into the movie. But the ones who've made the movie the most successful possible are the Jews, because the Jews can't ignore anything. If the movie would be ignored, it's a lousy movie. People can barely sit through it. It's 126 minutes, over 2 hours. So, you know, the movie would, he'd never see the $25 million he invested back again, right? But the Jews jumped on the bandwagon right away, right? So now everybody has to see the movie because everybody has to decide, is it anti-Semitic, is it not anti-Semitic? Is it good or is it not good, right? I expect that there'll be synagogues that'll show it. And so, yeah, we gave him, I would estimate, $100 million of free publicity. And made it into a cause célèbre. It's not the first movie about the passion of Jesus that has been made in Hollywood. There have been movies before. But all those movies, went nowhere and didn't do anything to anybody. But here, it's part of our paranoia, since the whole world is on against us, which it is, right? So, therefore, this just adds fuel to the fire. And the Jews jumped in and helped create the monster that we are witness to. So we'll see how it'll play out. No one knows how it will play out, but my opinion is that whatever happens, we could have lived without it. And there was an excellent article, this I conclude, there's an excellent article written by George Will, who is a great columnist, and yesterday's paper, I saw it in the Chicago paper, in which he says the movie is not the problem for the Jews. The real problem for the Jews is the anti-Semitism of the left, of the intelligentsia, of the professors, of the colleges. That's where the problem of anti-Semitism lies today. It doesn't lie in the movie. The movie won't help it, but that's not our immediate threat. Our threat are these guys who think that they think, and who therefore have legitimized anti-Semitism, have made it a cause, an intellectual cause that sweeps all intellectual circles and causes us great harm. So we have to hope the Lord will protect us from all of this, and that in the meantime He'll also be able to protect us from ourselves.
This concludes this lecture by Rabbi Beryl Wine. For information, please contact the Destiny Foundation at 1-800-499-WINE. That's 1-800-499-9346, or at our 24-hour fax number, 845-356-7733. We can also be reached by email at info@jewishdestiny.com or online at www.rabbiwine.com. Due to copyright laws, we kindly request that there be no duplication of this lecture except through the Destiny Foundation.